Hello, and welcome to episode 145 of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matthew Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. And on this week's episode, we interview Bill Harlow, a retired Navy captain with a career in public affairs, about his work in strategic communications in the security sector. We talk about his experiences in the White House at the end of the Cold War, the intelligence community during 9/11, and how that all paved the way for his current work in the private sector. We'll get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
And we're back. As I mentioned at the top, I'm here with Bill Harlow of Bill Harlow Communications. Bill, thank you very much for being with us on Sea Control today.
My pleasure.
Now, as is Sea Control tradition, please introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your professional background, what you're up to now, and how you got from where you started your career to where you are at the moment.
Well, I'd like to think of myself as a communications professional. I started out in the Navy, got a commission through ROTC from Villanova, and spent 25 fascinating years in the Navy, most of that as a public affairs professional within the Navy. I had a number of very interesting tours while on active duty, including 4 years at the White House press office, duty in the Pentagon many times in various spokesman positions, chief spokesman for the Secretary of the Navy. And retired as a Navy captain in 1997 and went to work as chief spokesman for a secret organization. Sounds like it should be a pretty easy job. I was a spokesman for the CIA for 7 years, from 97 to 2004. I left that job and did a couple things. One was writing, helping various people, mostly former CIA officials, write memoirs and books. I do that under my Bill Harlow Communications hat. And then I also started a company called 15 Seconds. 15seconds.com with Fred Francis, a former NBC news correspondent. And we do crisis communications and media training, telling clients how to approach dealing with the media from the dual perspective of Fred, who spent 40 years in network news, and my perspective of spending almost that much time as a government spokesman. So it provides a unique perspective to people about how to deal with the media in the current environment.
Well, that's a very broad and diverse set of career experiences, so I guess what we'll do, let's start from the beginning. As you can imagine, and as our listeners already know, most of the people that we have come through military backgrounds on Sea Control end up talking about more kinetic topics, or most of them have at some point either SWO or submarine backgrounds, something within the fleet, but you ended up in public affairs. What made you want to go down the public affairs route, and how did you end up getting involved in that world?
Well, I always had an interest in communications and media relations and those kind of things, but I owed the Navy 4 years of service for my ROTC scholarship. And fortunately, after a couple of puts and takes, I ended up aboard USS Midway as the collateral duty public affairs officer on Midway. I got on board in Alameda, and about 3 days later, the ship got underway for Japan for a cruise that lasted a couple of generations. But I was fortunate enough to be on board when the Midway went to Yokosuka for the first time. And while on board, was able to run the ship's newspaper, the closed-circuit radio and TV station, deal with crises that we had on board, things like that, while also standing bridge watches from time to time. And although I eventually qualified as officer of the deck underway in the Midway, I was having more fun doing the communicating part of it than driving the ship. So at the end of my tour there, I applied for conversion to the public affairs designator within the Navy. It's a very small community within the Navy. Public affairs specialists who do that solely for the rest of their careers, and I was fortunate enough to be selected and to, when I went ashore from Midway, be able to build on what I learned in the fleet to help tell the story of the Navy for the next 20 plus years.
So before we go into the specific places that you ended up working as a public affairs officer that you mentioned during your introduction, I wanted to ask a more general question in terms of what then is the traditional glide path and the traditional trajectory for a person that is doing public affairs in either the Navy or the military services? What kind of assignments do you normally end up getting? What are the standard kind of cycles that you go through to get into those positions? And how exactly does a public affairs career end up unfolding?
it varies widely, and it certainly varies even more widely if you talk about the different services. The Navy, I think, has the best track record of training and deploying their spokespeople. They give them a lot of responsibility early on, which is typical of the Navy in general, as you know. And they tend to put their spokespeople in areas of fleet concentrations, whether it's Norfolk or San Diego or whatever, or places where there's lots of communications opportunities like the Pentagon. And there, again, there's only a small number of people. I think when I was in, there was less than 200 total, from the senior most person, usually a one star, down to the junior most person who might be a JG or lieutenant. And so they're spread fairly thinly, but you get an opportunity to deal with both media relations, dealing with the press, with internal relations, communicating within the Navy, whether it's through closed circuit TV or through other broadcasts or internet platforms now, and community relations, dealing with the public, trying to get the public to understand what the Navy does and why it does it, to try to build support. That can be everything from working with the bands to the Blue Angels to all manner of things. So those are the kind of jobs that you end up getting within the public affairs community.
And you mentioned during your introduction then, if now that we go into specifics, that you had some pretty high profile and some very high visibility positions as part of that group. So let's talk a little bit about your time at the White House. From looking at your bio and seeing the years, you were there right during the transition between President Reagan and President Herbert Walker Bush, which was obviously a very interesting time for both national politics and also international politics, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the establishment of the New World Order, a complete redefinition of the world as we knew it, which means that as things are changing quickly, I'm sure it was very, to put it mildly, interesting, to say nothing of difficult, to sort of keep abreast of those changes and communicate what the White House was doing and basically what the world was becoming. So tell us a little bit about what your time was like in the White House during that time, and particularly the transition between the two presidents and the transition of world order.
Yeah, it was a fascinating time to be there. I guess it's probably any time at the White House is fascinating, but it certainly seemed to me that I was fortunate to be there at that particular time in history. And it wasn't meant to be as long as it turned out to be. At the end of the Reagan administration, there was a vacancy in the White House press office in the part that handled national security. Right now, they've reorganized several times back and forth, but now that particular slot would be assigned to the National Security Council staff. But at the time, we were considered White House staff. And there was a vacancy at the end of the Reagan administration, and there weren't any civilians beating down the door to take the job because there was only a few months left in the administration. And so people didn't want to leave a paying job to go there. And so the people at the White House thought, well, maybe we can get a military guy just to fill in for the final 9 months of the Reagan administration. And they called over to the senior spokesman for the Pentagon and asked him if he knew of anybody who might fit the bill. And at the time, I was a senior military assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs. And he asked me for a recommendation. And I said, how about me? And he kindly said, sure, go over and interview. And I went over and interviewed. Was fortunate enough to be selected for what I thought, again, was going to be a nine-month job. But then when President George Herbert Walker Bush won election, he asked the Presidential Press Secretary, Marlon Fitzwater, under President Reagan, to stick around and keep that same job in the new administration. And Marlon was kind enough to ask me if I would like to stay for a little bit longer. And I said, heck yes. So I took what was going to be a nine-month temporary assignment and milked it for about 4 years. It was a remarkable time to be there. President Reagan was a fascinating, wonderful guy to be around. You knew you were in the presence of somebody who was really powerful, but he was also very, it was like your favorite uncle. You couldn't help but like the guy if you were around him a little bit. He was truly a great communicator, and he spent a lot of time working on his communications. And so for a public affairs guy, that was a wonderful thing to observe and to be, play a small part in. I was there, again, toward the end of his administration when he went to Moscow for the first time for a summit meeting and things like that. Traveled with the president a little bit, and just was a fascinating time. Then the vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush, becomes president, and it was a remarkable period in history. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the first Gulf War, the Soviet Union coming apart. Again, I was privileged to be able to travel with him around the world to a number of events and to be there taking part in figuring out how do we deal with these crises, how do you respond to a situation like the Berlin Wall coming down. I think President Bush doesn't get nearly enough credit for the way he handled all those things so masterfully. He could have said or done things which would have triggered a negative response from the Soviet Union, but he handled it just perfectly in a way which allowed the Soviet Union to take itself apart without taking down large portions of the West with them. So it was a wonderful opportunity. Working at the White House is, of course, a privilege. The one thing I would say that's different about working at the White House than working in the military is that almost everyone at the White House understood the importance of communications. And so you never had a problem getting the attention of some senior official to get them to give you information that you could use to respond to the media, to talk to them and think through the implications of how their actions would be viewed by the media. Sometimes in the military, you run into senior officials who think, my job is to be a warfighter. That's all I care about. Public doesn't have a need to know anything that what we're doing. And therefore, you press guys, you know, stay out of the way. That was not the situation in the White House, where they understood by the very nature of their jobs that they had to communicate effectively in order to do a good job for the administration and for the country.
And so when you're within the White House versus the military, so there's the difference between how the senior leaders view the need for communications. What about the battle rhythm and sort of the day-to-day work? Was it fundamentally the same between those two organizations, even though the leadership sort of put a different emphasis on strategic communications? Or is the nature of doing public affairs work kind of the same, regardless of whether you're on the civilian White House side or the more military DOD side?
I think it's close to the same. I brought with me sort of a military ethic when I got to the White House. I was made a point of getting in an hour ahead of my boss, you know, which is a typical military thing when you're an aide or a military assistant or something like that, and just immersing myself in the information to try to stay ahead of the game because there's so much information coming in, so many things that you need to anticipate and deal with. And like in any organization, you just never know what's going to come at you. There's just so many possibilities that you need to stay on top of things. The last thing you want at the White House or in any senior military command is to be surprised by actions that there's any way of knowing that it's coming, that you want to stay ahead of the curve. But it was challenging, and I'm sure it's even more so today given the plethora of media outlets that are there to deal with. It must be even harder to stay ahead of the game.
So that's what it's like on the civilian or the government civilian side and then on the military side. So let's talk about the third leg of that stool that you mentioned, which is secret organizations. So you went to work for the CIA, was in 1997?
That's correct, yes.
So in 1997, you joined the CIA as a communications person, as chief spokesman. You hold that position for a number of years. So tell us, what was then the difference working on the intelligence side? And as you mentioned, what is it like to be in charge of and responsible for communications in an organization whose primary cultural aspect is to try to give away as little information as possible?
Yeah, it was certainly challenging. And I thought going into it that I would have a little bit of a leg up on it because I had worked in the military and from time to time had worked with the Navy submarine community, for example, which is notably tight-lipped and special warfare communities and things like that. The CIA takes it obviously to a completely different level, and there are a large number of people within the organization who will forever think that the only response to any question should be no comment, and that they would be just as happy if the press shop didn't exist. But my argument, and the argument which my boss, George Tenet, fully endorsed, was that the agency has a responsibility to talk about what it can, so that in those occasions when it must be secret, it has some credibility. When you say everything in the world is classified, everything is to be responded with no comment, then you have no standing if there's media come to you having learned something secretive and you ask them, please don't report that because it would do damage to national security. You have no standing if you've been telling them the same thing all along for every simple question that they might ask. There's also an opportunity because of the nature of the organization. There are things that the intelligence community does that can be talked about. There's analysis that they do that is quite valuable to the public and the private sector. There are actions taken that can be spoken about. And if you put some deposits in the credibility bank, you're able to describe a few of the successes, the inevitable stories that get out there about the failures that the intelligence community might have or about the other difficulties that it may run into, you've got more ability to offset that if you play the game. If you totally stiff the media, if you totally refuse to respond to any question when stuff goes badly, and it will inevitably, you've got little leg to stand on to try to put it in perspective.
So let's talk then about some of the specific events that happened while you were at the CIA, because you were there for a number of years, and I would say the two that sort of pop up are 9/11 and the prosecution of the Iraq War. So I was wondering if you could walk through then some of the specifics that you actually can talk about in your role, what it was like to be there during that tumultuous time and that very difficult time for our country.
Yeah, again, it was a fascinating time to be where I happened to be. The CIA was the one part of the government that was most alarmed about the potential threat from al-Qaeda for a number of years, from when I first got there in 97 up until today. It was very worried about it, working aggressively against that target, but it was a very difficult one to get attention to. If you go back and you look at the public testimony that the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, made in 1998, 99, 2000, even in the early 2001, he was saying things like al-Qaeda could attack at any moment without further notice. And so we were trying to get the word out that this was a serious situation of extraordinary concern to the agency and to the nation. But again, you run into the difficulties of not being able to talk about many of the things that you're doing. And also, there's just so much that's unknown about it. But we were definitely feeling the potential pressure of that situation, as the 9/11 Commission report quotes that Director Tenet was saying at the time, that the system was blinking red, that we knew something big was coming. We didn't know precisely where, we didn't know precisely when, we didn't know how it would happen. We were trying to raise the alarm within government, but there's only so much you can do there, because if you can't tell them precisely what's going to happen or where, they say to you, aren't you guys just crying wolf again? So there was tremendous feeling of pressure at the time. And then when 9/11 happened, I was at the CIA headquarters that morning, and we're in a senior staff meeting. And one of the watch officers came into the director's conference room and said a plane has just hit the World Trade Center. And while many people will say their initial reaction was, you know, this is probably a small plane, just got lost or something, I think our reaction there generally was, you know, it could well be al-Qaeda. And then went back to my office and saw the second plane hit and certainly knew instantly that it was. Then the tremendous outpouring of support that the entire country came together to try to band together against this fight, and the wonderful work that was done by the agency and the special warfare community in going into Afghanistan just a couple of weeks after 9/11, essentially routing the Taliban and getting the al-Qaeda on the run, was a very dramatic period in the country's history. And then inevitably what happens after a crisis like that, first reaction is that people pull together and work together, and the second reaction is that people start pointing fingers. Well, why didn't somebody tell us? Why didn't you stop this? Why didn't you do whatever it is that in retrospect should have been done? And after a crisis, whether it's that one, whether it's any other one that you can name, it's very easy to go back and look at things that might have been done, should have been done. You now have the complete picture, and you can go back and you can find the pieces of the puzzle that were missed. At the time when you're in the run-up to a crisis, the cliche is that it's like having a jigsaw puzzle without the box top. Well, worse than that, it's the jigsaw puzzle without the box top and thousands of pieces of other jigsaw puzzles mixed in among them that look like they might fit, but they really don't fit. So after the fact, you know precisely what to look for. You can find those pieces. You can put it together and understand what may have happened and what might have been missed. And the lead-up, it's a different picture. So that was the 9/11 and the aftermath to it was a period of tremendous work, of effort, of focus at the agency. And I was privileged to be there and help tell as much of that story as we could at the time and help to try to explain the things that we couldn't answer the question, John, trying to explain why we couldn't answer the question. That whole atmosphere played into the next one that you mentioned, the run-up to the Iraq War. You can't overstate how much the impact of 9/11 had on the thinking within the administration about dealing with the potential threat of Iraq. And there were a couple of mainstreams that touched on the things that I was able to deal with at the time. One was the terrorism threat, and there were a lot of people who were connecting Iraq to al-Qaeda inappropriately, we thought, they were overstressing, this is outside the intelligence community, overstressing the potential connections between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. And I spent a lot of my time, to the extent that I could, factually dealing with that, trying to knock down the notion that there were some direct link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, things like that. And then there was the WMD portion, and as Paul Wolfowitz famously said at one point, that was the one thing that everybody could agree on. Every intelligence service around the country, including Saddam's, I would bet you, every pundit, for the most part, was pretty well convinced that Saddam had some fashion of weapons of mass destruction. Turned out that it was nowhere near as far along as feared, and you can write books, and I've helped write a couple to get into great detail about how that happened, how it could have happened. But it was a tremendously complex period in the country's life, and there was a feeling of, we don't want to get this one wrong. If we get this one wrong and we underestimated it, the results could be catastrophic. You could argue that we got it wrong in the other direction, and we certainly did. But it was a difficult period in the life of the intelligence community and the country's history.
And then not too long after that, you ended up retiring from your role inside the military and then taking that experience to the ventures that you're working on now. So the PR firm, Bill Harlow Communications, and then also 15 Seconds, which you mentioned earlier that you co-founded with someone from NBC. So what was that transition like to go from what must have been probably the most difficult part of your career in dealing with 9/11 and the lead up to the Iraq War and the immediate aftermath into the private sector just all of a sudden? Was it a difficult transition? Was it hard to sort of learn the new tricks and tips and things that you had to figure out? Or was the transition relatively smooth? Like, what kind of things did you learn from the course of that? And what things in your previous career helped you for your new one?
Well, backing up a little bit, I had actually retired from the Navy before I took the job at the CIA. So I had been out of the Navy for a while, although I left the Navy on a Friday and started on a Monday at the CIA. The only difference was showing up in civilian clothes, but there wasn't much difference between those 25 years in the Navy and 7 years at the CIA. Then all of a sudden, I left the CIA. Frankly, I think after 32 years of fairly intense service, I was kind of exhausted. And so I welcomed the opportunity to not show up at work at 5:30 or 6 in the morning every day and stay until 7 or 8 at night. Initially, one of the things, the projects that I undertook shortly after leaving the agency was to help George Tenet with his memoirs, which were published in 2007 in a book called At the Center of the Storm. And that, too, was a fairly intense process, a very difficult one to figure out what could be said and help him get it written and get it through the CIA clearance process, which is challenging. So that kept me busy. And at the same time, I was standing up this other company, the 15 Seconds, with Fred Francis, where we were trying to pitch ourselves to both the private sector, and we have a few governmental clients as well, where we help train people on how to deal with the media. So all that kept me busy, and it was an interesting change of pace. So it wasn't as difficult a transition as I might have feared.
And so with all of those things that ended up happening to you, how much would you say for not just your transition, but also for the opportunities that you got, say, for example, that you already knew George Tenet beforehand and you got sort of put into these interesting positions, how much of that did you say that you kind of built intentionally, that you worked on, and how much happened by luck?
I think about 90% of life is luck. You just keep showing up to work and doing the best you can and networking to the extent that you can. And I never planned to be the spokesman for the CIA. In fact, when I was retiring from the Navy, the one thing I didn't want to do was go back to work for the government. At the time, you had to give up most of your retired pay if you went back to work as a civil servant. And it made no sense for me to do that at all. So when the guy who was the spokesman for the CIA was leaving by the time I was shopping around for the job, and I knew him from the Pentagon in the past, and he asked me if I wanted to go over an interview for his job, and I had no intention of getting that job. I thought it might be good practice to interview over there, and then when I went out to the private sector, I'd have more practice job interviews, because usually in the military, as you know, you don't do job interviews. That's not really the way you get assignments. And so I went over it, thinking I would work my way up through the bureaucracy of a few people and just practice my interview skills. Well, the first guy I interviewed with was George Tenet, and just hit it off with a guy. I just was totally impressed with him, and I thought, you know, it might be fun to work with him for a year or two and then go off into the private sector. Well, a year or two turned into 7 years, and never planned it that way, but it turned out to be a wonderful thing. I didn't anticipate that so many historic things would happen, and when they did, and convinced him that he ought to tell his story, or help convince him that, and he asked me to help him do it, so it just one thing led to another. I think if you try to plan it, never would have happened. When I went to the White House, I was only going there for 9 months. It was a temporary job, and I had no way of knowing that President Bush would be elected, or that he would ask Marlon Fitzwater to stick around, or Marlon would ask me to stick around. So it's just the luck of the draw, and I've been very lucky.
So then let's talk a little bit more about the crisis communications aspect, since you lived through crisis communications and now your 15 Seconds firm is highlighting that as something important. I imagine that 15 Seconds probably has something to do with crisis communications. So if you could walk us through, why did you found that particular organization and company? And what is it like to handle crisis communications? How do you do it? How is it different from non-crisis public relations? And anything that the people out in the audience, whether they're in the fleet or they're in defense jobs or analysts, should know about how that world works so they can do their own work better?
We call the company 15 Seconds. It's sort of a play on Andy Warhol's, in the future, everybody will be famous for 15 minutes. He said that 40 years ago, and things have sped up so much now that you only get 15 seconds. And our theory is that in a crisis situation, you've got to respond enormously fast in order to get ahead of the curve, in order to establish what you want to say, because everybody else is going to be out there. All your competitors, all of the people who are your opponents, all the pundits, all the people who are just looking to get some notoriety will be out there talking about your issue, whether you want to be or not. So the difference between crisis communications and normal public relations, one is that you don't really get a vote on whether you play or not. If you're at Equifax and you've just been hacked and lost the details of 143 million people, you got to get out there and talk about it, whether you want to or not, because otherwise your company is going to be decimated. In a normal situation, people in organizations can pick and choose, do I want to engage, do I not want to engage, do I want to put out a spokesman, do I want to just respond in a written response, can I just let this go and just keep our head down and maybe we'll do fine. But in a crisis situation, you've got to play, because otherwise you're just going to have your head handed to you by everybody else who's going to be damning you, putting out information which may or may not be true, and redefining your organization. So it's a challenge, and we think that organizations who only think about crisis communications after the crisis hits have put themselves in a very difficult position. Yeah, because if you haven't thought through how you would respond to a crisis, if you haven't thought through who would be your spokesman on it, if you haven't thought through what are the mechanisms that I would get information out, do I just put out a press release, do I hold a press conference, and do I know how to hold a press conference, do I know where to hold it, all those things, if you haven't thought through it in advance, the chances of it coming out perfectly well aren't so good.
Awesome. Now, let's talk also then about the part of your career that you alluded to when you're talking about helping write At the Center of the Storm with George Tenet, his memoirs. You've written a number of other books, too, with Michael Morell and a few others, primarily about Al-Qaeda and the war on terrorism and the experience that you went through, or that you at least observed from your vantage point. How did you end up deciding to pursue that business model of helping others write their stories? And how is that different from other kinds of writing that you have had to do either in your private sector or in your public sector PR roles?
Well, the first book I wrote was actually a novel that I wrote toward the end of my time in the Navy called Circle William. And it was about two brothers, one who was a White House press secretary, obviously based on my experience, and the other captain of an Arleigh Burke destroyer. And that was actually based on a friend of mine and yours, Jim Stavridis, who at the time, I had worked with him in the Secretary of the Navy staff, and when he was a young commander. And so using those two worlds, the Navy and the White House press operation, I worked on this novel, which was reasonably well received. And I wasn't able to promote it too much because by the time it came out, I was at the CIA and I had a full-time job, but it was an interesting experience, and simply getting published is both rewarding and challenging. So I had been through the process. Then at the end of my time at the CIA, having been published once, at least I knew the mechanics of doing it, and I had this belief that Georgetown had a terrific story to tell, and I wanted to help him tell it. And it came out very well. His book opened number one in the New York Times bestseller list, so you can't complain about that. But I didn't intend to get into that line of work, as you phrased it. But having done that successfully with Tenet, then other books, opportunities presented themselves to me. And I'm fortunate in that just about every book that I've co-authored, the people I've co-authored them with were first friends before they were co-authors. So Michael Morrell and Jose Rodriguez. Jim Mitchell is the most recent one. I didn't know him very well, but I had met him at the CIA. So these are people I certainly knew of and in most cases knew well and were friendly with. And that made the process a lot easier to do, to help them tell their stories. The important thing is just their story. It's not my story. But they're also all very busy people. And to the extent that I can help them convey what they want to convey about the lessons learned from their time in government, it's been a worthwhile and rewarding experience.
So since you've done this a number of times already, do you have any writing advice for our people out in our audience who I imagine most of them are more used to, say, writing blog posts for SimSec or doing background papers in their government jobs? Any writing advice that you've sort of gleaned both from your time in uniform as a government civilian and also as a writer?
Yeah, well, one bit of advice would be to keep writing, something that gets better, gets easier anyway, the more you do it. And to the extent that if you let that skill atrophy, it takes a while to get back in the saddle. And don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Just keep writing and writing. The other bit of advice to paraphrase Elmore Leonard, is when you're writing, to leave out the parts that people are going to skip anyway. I see a lot of people writing things, and it's way too long. I get a lot of former CIA and military people who want to write novels or want to write nonfiction books who come to me and ask for some advice. And what I tend to see is that they write too much. People who write books, which if they ever got published, you know, would kill thousands of trees. It's much better to leave people wanting more than to have them wanting less. So to the extent that you write stuff, if you can keep it punchy, memorable, short, it's to your advantage. Now, there are times when you needed to write long. The Tenet book, At the Center of the Storm, was a pretty hefty-sized book, but he had so much material to cover and so many historical things that justified it. But for most of us, you're writing material to keep it punchy and short is much better.
Excellent. Now, since we've reached the end of our episode, let's conclude it the same way we conclude every episode, especially since you've worked in communications, you likely know this question well. What kind of things are you reading nowadays? And for the people out in the audience who are either interested in more in the public relations and public affairs world, or just interested in kind of what's on your mind, what things would you recommend they pick up?
I don't read a whole lot about the public affairs world, so I may let down your readers in that regard. I tend to find myself reading more nonfiction, historical stuff. That's what interests me, and when I break away from my daily routine, that's what I tend to focus on. One book I'm reading now is Churchill and Orwell by Tom Ricks. Terrific book. I am only about halfway through it, but I would never have thought to have combined those two people in a single book, but Tom is doing a great job at it. Has done a great job in telling the two stories of two quite remarkable men during a critical period in the world's history. Tom was somebody I knew when he was a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and has been someone who's given me writing advice early on, so I certainly respect everything that he does. I also read some stuff that sort of on the periphery of things that I have done. Or there's a number of books by former CIA officials or people who are interested in CIA things. There's one coming out soon from the Naval Institute Press called Operation Blackmail about Betty McIntosh, who was a woman in the OSS in World War II in the Pacific who had a remarkable career. And that's a book that I read in galley form and is well worth the read by people who listen to your blog who are interested in World War II history and espionage. It's quite a remarkable book.
I'll definitely have to pick that up when it comes out, for sure. Well, thank you again, Bill, for taking the time today. Really appreciate you appearing on Sea Control, and best of luck in all of your ventures, writing, and communications, and otherwise.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
That concludes episode 145 of the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matt Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. Special thanks to our guest this week, Bill Harlow, and our producer for this episode, Chris Lee. If you enjoyed this episode and you haven't already yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. And if you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Sea Control.